Good afternoon. I'm calling the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. This is Friday, April 19th. Let the record reflect the time is 1:39 p.m. Today we have present online on the phone Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Machicki, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Hughes. Senator Showers excused. I'd like to remind committee members and those in the audience to silence or turn off your cell phones, please. Thank you today, Nancy Hemingway, Eileen Keim, and Buddy Witt for assisting us. We have two items on today's agenda. First, we'll continue work on SJR 4, Constitutional Amendment, State Tax Initiative sponsored by the Governor. And following that, we'll introduce a new working document for Senate Bill 33, Arrest, Release, Sentencing, Probation, and consider amendments from Senator Keel. I'd like to ask committee members to keep your questions, comments focused on the items before the committee. Concise questions, thoughtful brevity are the order of the day. SJR 4 was introduced to the committee on April 4th, and the committee took public testimony that evening. We had the bill scheduled this past Monday, but did not have enough time to get to it, unfortunately. Committee members received a memo from our legislative legal team, and we asked the Department of Law to weigh in on that. So this afternoon, I'd like to invite Ms. Corey Mills and Mr. Bill Milks from the Department of Law to the table to briefly review their response to the technical issue identified by Ledge Legal. So Corey was in the room earlier, and I suppose she's coming back. Mr. Mills, should we take a brief at ease and wait for her, or?
I think we can go forward.
Okay, thank you. So if you could please introduce yourself, and we'll go over the memo that you sent, please, regarding technical questions related to SJR 4.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Milks, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. So as the Chair just explained, Department of Law provided a letter memo to the committee dated April 15th addressing certain issues that were raised pursuant to the Chair's request that were raised by Division of Legislative Legal Services. I guess the first one we've gone in order, there was a question about the the administration's intent regarding issues such as, you know, the definition of new taxes and increased tax rates. We've had discussion on the record of the administration's intent that the changes to, for example, deductions or credits or exemptions from an existing state tax would not be covered by this amendment, thereby meaning not trigger a vote of the people to review that legislative change. As far as further clarification, we did offer one suggestion which will appear in an amendment that I understand the committee will review later today, and that was we said that we could insert the term word nominal in front of tax rate to clarify that the intent here again was that it would be an increase in the nominal tax rate, meaning the number that would be covered by this amendment, and not a change in an individual's effective tax rate. So the number is 10, moves to 11 by action of the legislature or the voters, then that would trigger the terms of the amendment, of the constitutional amendment.
Mr. Milk, just to get on the record then, so if there were, for instance, an initiative that would change something regarding tax credits or deductions, and it would effectively change the tax rate, that this would not apply. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, you are correct. That is the administration's intention on that.
Okay, thank you.
The next issue, sort of going through our memorandum, was there was questions about what about different scenarios, say example a bill that created several new taxes, how would this provision work, or created a tax as well as a regulatory program, and again I think we testified to this, but we provide clarification in our letter that if a bill passes that has multiple new taxes, each of those new taxes would be presented to the voters to consider separately. If a program was passed by law that both created a new tax or increased an existing tax and also had regulatory changes, again, this proposed amendment is only focused on taxes. So only the portion of that law that changed a tax to increase it or create a new tax would be subject to the provisions of this amendment. Another question raised that we responded to was, what about a circumstance in which a bill passed that decreased a tax and then a referendum of the voters rejected that, which would mean you go back to the existing tax? Would that be covered by the amendment? And the answer is no, it would not be covered by the amendment. The amendment does not speak to referendum in that circumstance. It speaks instead to increase in a tax rate or a new tax passed by the legislature or the voters by initiative. Another question raised was the issue of, there's two more issues raised in here which the committee will have amendments on that I've seen. One concerned clarification regarding Article 9, Section 1. And that is covered by that's a specification clarifying that on the initiative laws, that an initial law becomes, there is an exception to the effective date of an initiative law by virtue of this amendment, which would mean that initiative laws become effective pursuant to constitutional provision, Article 11, Section 6, except for if we're dealing with subjects of the tax change. And in that circumstance, this amendment would govern, which means that the initiative law would not become final law on 90 days later. Instead, it would be subject to the process by which the legislature would review that law. Another issue addressed was concern the future, clarifying on questions that dealt with the tax year to try to avoid difficulty in establishing a new tax by the possibility of having a new tax become effective mid-year. We address that. We respond to the idea that amending this proposed amendment to provide that the a new tax will become effective January 1 of the following fiscal year. And I believe the committee has an amendment to that effect. There was a question about that sort of dealt with the issue of whether or not the legislature's uniform rules would have to be modified if the amendment passed. That's possible, but that doesn't impact the constitutional amendment. You wouldn't address that in the proposed amendment. I think that's sort of outlines our response to a variety of some technical issues and further explanations reiterating the scope of this proposed constitutional amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Milks. And I'm going to put on the record, I believe that in the memo from Ledge Legal, Emily Nauman, she did a very good job bringing some things to our attention I think were important for us to consider to address the amendment, and also just to get on the record. And one of those, and maybe you hit on it and I missed it, what were to happen if there were an expansion to a new group or a new product, for instance, e-cigs? Would this apply?
Through the chair, I think what we're talking about, as I understand that scenario, a new tax would be applied to a new product, then this amendment would apply.
And what about to a new group of taxpayers?
Well, it would apply to that new group of taxpayers, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other clarification questions that anyone would like to ask in regard to this memo? And is there anything, Corey, you were invited up earlier, but you weren't in the room. Is there anything that you would like to add? And it looks like she is saying no. And so with that, thank you, Mr. Milks. Thank you for appearing before us. And now I'd like to move to the amendments for SJR 4, and I have four of them, and I'd like to invite Mr. Earl Edward Witt III up to the table.
Madam.
As he is indicated here on my screen, his name. So did you have a comment?
Question for Emily.
Certainly. Senator Michicki. Emily Nauman, we have a question for you.
Hello, Emily. Your comments on revision, you're fairly convinced that this is not an amendment. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, that's correct. And I apologize for the record. This is Emily Nauman with Legislative Legal.
Okay. So are we making a political statement, or do we just not care on that issue? Because I think in this case, you're talking about a substantial shift. If you look at today's statement that the power of taxation shall never be surrendered or contracted away, we are surrendering and contracting away the power of taxation. And it's really a popular thing. I get it. It sounds like a good idea. I personally think it results in a tax sooner. And I've already stated on the record my concerns that, frankly, it takes the only people losing rights in SSJR are the people of Alaska on the initiative process. That's fine. I don't need to go on with it. I think on the bumper sticker, this sounds like a really good idea for conservatives that think they're gaining something, but the reality of it is they're losing substantially.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. And one of the amendments will address that a bit, maybe not to the full extent. Of course, that can be reconsidered in Senate Finance Committee. And I'll point out also that we're really just moving up the timeline instead of the two-year delay that is already in place right now with an initiative. But our amendment, when we come to it, you will see that it does change it a bit the way it's originally structured. So with that, I move amendment number one. Would you like to object for purposes of discussion?
I object, Madam Chair, for purposes of discussion.
And Mr. Witt, would you like to share with us what amendment number one does?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Buddy Witt, staff to Chair Hughes. Amendment number one speaks to the issue the Department of Law raised in meetings with the chair and staff, and this was a suggested fix to the effective date concerns. What this amendment does is on page one, it inserts a new bill section for Article 2, Section 18 of the Constitution having to do with effective dates. And this just adds a line to the end of that section of the Constitution that says this section does not apply to a law establishing a state tax or increasing a state tax under Section 1B of Article 9. Then it skips forward to actually change the effective date to January 1 of the fiscal year following the statewide voter referendum. So, for an example, the statewide election in November of a certain year, in the following January, the legislature reconvenes. They make a decision regarding the voter referendum. The effective date would actually be the following January 1, because it would be in the next January 1 of the next fiscal year.
And therefore, just a little correction, not the voter referendum, but the voter initiative.
Voter initiative, thank you. Voter initiative. So it would be January 1 of the next year, thereby giving a little bit, almost an entire year for the administration or whatever department that the particular tax affects to get everything in order to start the new tax year.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. so this is definitely cleaner than the original draft. I can envision, as I try and think, you know, decades down the road, some of our seasonal activities, seasonal industries are wintertime activities. Something that began January 1 would be in the middle of a season for them. I have a community with a lot of tourism, so I often think about the cruise season or the summer tour season, so January 1's no problem. But if we want to heliskiing or something that impacts, that requires winter ice roads to happen, is there a provision then, is there a way with this amendment that the legislature or the voters could adjust to a different fiscal quarter, a different start date, or we're straight up at January 1 no matter what?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, this is definitely outside of my scope of expertise, but and perhaps the administration would come up to speak to that. My guess would be that anytime there is a new tax, the tax starts and ends on January 1st of a year and December 31st of that year, and there would be provisions in place for people to get ready for that. This isn't the first time that a tax, it's not like we've never had a tax before. We've never implemented a new tax before. So my guess would be they know exactly how to do that.
And I'll just throw in there, I'm sure that typically businesses go with a January 1 to December 31st bookkeeping and tax year, so even seasonal, whether it's spring, summer, fall, winter. So I think that's pretty typical for companies. Mr. Barnhill, if you want to come up and respond to that.
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Mike Barnhill, OMB Policy Director. So the answer is this establishes the effective date on January 1st for everything. In the event that you have a heliskiing company that has a season that begins October 1st, that would be 3 months tax-free when the tax begins, so hooray. I don't see it's a problem. January 1st, from a tax administration perspective, is just standard.
Thank you. Lots of business October, November, December. Senator Keel.
Always hoping for more, Madam Chair. The other question, just on the mechanics of this amendment, I know that in the past, from time to time, the legislature has used a retrospective effect, started a change in a tax code looking back. And if I remember right, the Alaska Supreme Court has said that retroactivity is not an effective date. Is it available under the language in Amendment 1?
Oh, my. Madam Chair, that sounds like a legal question.
If only there were a lawyer.
If only I was. But even if I was, I don't think I could answer that at the moment. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. We can follow up with that particular question for you at some point, or is that?
Miles to go before it sleeps, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Michicki.
Just for anyone listening, here's what this does. This makes it impossible for the legislature to respond to a substantial drop in the price of oil. So we're going to put the dividend in the Constitution. We're paying out a full dividend. You've got X amount of revenue coming in. You've got things that are in your way. You're not always going to have $17 billion in the earnings reserve. Heck, low oil prices have been on for a while. You may not have anything in the CBR, nothing in the earnings reserve. And in order to keep the state operating, you may need a tax someday. I don't support taxes right now. I feel like I have to say that every time I say anything. But you may need one someday. Mm-hmm. This makes it where the legislature is essentially always in session, because it will take a year. Say that you pass something early, it would take a year before that could be approved. Even if you did a special session, it wouldn't become effective until January 1st of the next year. So it creates a completely unmanageable financial situation. The reasons I don't support this are not because it's not a really nice idea if it worked, but there's a reason why we've retained taxing power, and that is because it's hard to remember this because we've been so blessed for so many years, for generations we've been blessed. But it unfortunately, you might have to make a really unpopular decision someday to keep troopers employed, to keep schools open, to do the things that government does. And remember, the only thing government needs to do is bulk services people can't afford to do on their own, right? Extending the date and being at the whim of whether or not something passes and then having to manage that when it doesn't on November 2nd would require instantly coming back into special session, immediately having a special election, having to wait the following year for a correction on the next January 1st for an effective date. So it's we're not thinking through this. It sounds really good, but we're just not thinking it through.
Thank you, Senator Michicki, and appreciate that. You're speaking about the more in general about the bill itself, and we're on amendment number one, so just as far as that trigger date. But I will say, and we've heard that, you know, Colorado is case in point where they have done this, and I think it would, if the legislature were to pass a tax that was truly needed, there would have to be a lot of education for the public to be happening, and vice versa. There would have to be mutual agreement that we are in a place where perhaps oil prices are very low, and if we are going to continue services, that's what we might be facing. Would you like to respond to that, Mr. Barnhill?
Just briefly, Madam Chair, and with respect to Senator Michicki, I think there's a difference between making the enactment of a new tax or an increase in a tax rate more difficult, which this certainly does, and impossible, which this does not.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other question or discussion on the particular amendment as far as clarifying the effective date? Thank you, Mr. Barnhill. So, Senator Michicki, do you maintain your objection to the amendment, or do you want to remove it?
Can we have an at ease?
Sure. We're back on the record. Senator Michicki, you have a conceptual amendment to amendment number one?
I do, Madam Chair. I believe my conceptual amendment is eliminating on page two, lines 4, 5, and 6 of the amendment.
I have a question for Mr. Witt on that. If we want the possibility of the concurrence of two-thirds as another option, do we want to just delete the word delete, or do we want to delete all of lines 4, 5, and 6?
Same effect.
To the chair, it would have the same effect. So Senator Michicki is correct.
Oh, that's right, because it's in the bill now. Thank you. All right. So are there any objections to the conceptual amendment to amendment number one? Hearing none, the conceptual amendment is adopted. So we're back to the main amendment. Do you wish to remove your objection, Senator Michicki?
You bet, Madam Chair. I would love to remove my objection.
All right. Hearing no further objection, amendment number one is adopted. I move amendment number two.
Object for reasons of discussion.
Mr. Witt, can you tell us about amendment number two?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amendment number two replaces language on page 2, of the bill, lines 7 through 14. This was a concern brought up by Senator Michicki that we were with the bill, we were basically removing power from the people. So after discussion with Department of Law and looking at different ways that we could fix this, the request was made that we in this bill mirror Article 3 of the Constitution, Constitution under executive powers. And that would mean that instead of, as it says now in the bill, that the legislature by resolution would approve an initiated law by a majority vote, we're switching it and saying, and by the way, if they did not approve, it would the initiative would die. We're switching it. We're saying that the legislature by resolution would reject an initiative. Otherwise, that initiative would automatically become law, which is similar to executive order.
So if they did nothing, it would then become law. So it requires the legislature then to go on record. And after the people have weighed in, it's a lot more demanding of the legislature to go on record to oppose what the people have said. So we thought that was better than the way it was initially drafted. So are there comments or questions regarding Amendment Number 2? Senator Michicki?
Madam Chair, just to be clear, it does not replace that right. They've lost that right to initiative. It still comes back to the legislature. So the way it was set up before, I'm talking about the amendment, it's just important in this piece, is the legislature retained the right to tax, and then the people can go through their initiative process, or they can go through referendum to remove the tax. Or they also had the right to initiative, so they can create a law, whatever law they want to, with very few constraints, and it would come to the legislature, and the legislature would have to honor that for 2 years. And once it's been honored for 2 years, it's much more difficult to change because people remember that vote. All this amendment does is document how people vote when they take away the right to initiative for 2 years. It just documents the vote. Right.
I would agree that it documents, but it makes it a higher bar and more difficult to overturn what the people have passed, because legislators, I think, might be hesitant to go once against what the people have asked. And the way the bill reads right now, you would never really know who was not in agreement or who was in agreement. So it's somewhere in between. Senator Keel, did you have a comment or question?
thank you, Madam Chair. Just thinking it through, it ends up being a smaller reduction in the people's authority to pass an initiative than the original constitutional amendment proposed, but still a reduction.
And so in your mind, is that a slight improvement?
A small improvement.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions or comments? Senator Michicki?
I don't have any comments. I'll remove my objection, Madam Chair.
Are there any further objections? Hearing none, Amendment Number 2 has been adopted. I move Amendment Number 3. Senator Michicki?
I'll object for reasons of discussion.
Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It really does get easier from here. The change for Amendment 3 adds the word nominal before, on page 1, line 12, adds the word nominal before the word the, and specifying that we're looking at nominal tax rates or nominal rates, or following the word the. So it would be the nominal rate of an existing state tax. Does the same thing on page 2, line 8 as well. And as the Department of Law in their memo described that is a some cleanup language.
Any questions or comment regarding the insertion of the word nominal?
Not positive, Madam Chair.
Senator Michiki?
I'm sorry. I'm not positive that takes care of the issue. So think about, let's just put an example out there. You have a 35% base tax rate and oil taxes, but then you have this $5 per barrel. One might say that the 35% is the nominal rate. However, it's not, because it's inherently a part of the tax. It results in a nominal outcome. And I understand the argument. I get it. But it would be very easy to challenge in court. Taxes are not a base rate. They are a function of exclusions, deductions, and other levers that are designed for a specific outcome. And if I wanted to challenge something, I think you have a case where nominal in this case is not the nominal that you and I would think it would be. I think it, I don't know that it fixes that. And all that means is that you're going to, anything that you change is going to go to the people. If they challenge that you decided it's nominal and they decide it's not. But it's not a huge deal to me, but it's just something to think about.
Except the purpose of doing and getting on the record earlier is so that they could look back on this committee hearing and realizing we're talking just about the 35%. We're not talking about the deductions and other things. Mr. Barnhill, would you like to come up? I would be curious whether the word, when we say nominal tax rate, is that a standard term in the tax world that really is just the rate, the base rate itself, and does not include the other calculations that occur above
Madam Chair, again, Mike Barnhill, OMB. I don't know if it is a standard tax term or not, but what I think we can say very clearly on the record is that the 35% rate in the production tax statute is the nominal rate. So in order to trigger this legislation, there would have to be a change by the legislature of that nominal rate from 35% to some other number.
What I would suggest is if it's the will of the committee to adopt this amendment and ask that the Senate Finance Committee perhaps take this issue up again to find out if it is indeed a standard term that could be relied upon if this were to go to court.
We can certainly research that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Keel?
Madam Chair, I appreciate Mr. Barnhill's comments. I think it's a fairly standard term, and I think Senator Michiki was spot on. I mean, I don't think this is triggered if we were to pass a law that said we're going to apply a credit of minus $5 to every barrel of oil. It's not the nominal rate, but we've raised the taxable value for tax purposes by $5 and thus collected 35% of that. We can change the nominal rate. I think what Senator Michiki said was couldn't be more spot on. This is a can of worms. It's wriggling, and you can try to grab one of them, but the rest still wriggle. You've still got a can of worms.
Any final comments, Mr. Barnhill, regarding this?
I'm trying to come up with a pithy response to wriggling can of worms. I'm failing to do that.
Wiggling worms. They were wriggling worms, I'm noticing. So.
I think what we're trying to do here is bring some additional clarity for future cases that get litigated. I think in any event, we're dealing with amending the Constitution necessarily, there is broad terms that are used in constitutional language, leaving it up to the courts to ultimately decide whether the worm is wriggling or not.
Okay, thank you, Senator Michiki.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying, Madam Chair, is the legislature has been known to find workarounds. This it, it interjecting. So you either want everything to go to the people, even if it costs you more to put it on the ballot than the tax it's going to bring into the state when you brought up the vaping tax. You want everything to go to the people because that's a very popular thing to say. But by adding the words nominal, you create a workaround. So the reason I brought up the $5 per barrel is you can do a you could find another way to change the tax rate that didn't go to the people. You can get very crafty, and there are some folks that will look at it that way. But that's okay. I hear that you're trying to clarify that, and it may or may not. I think it may work the other way in this case. But
so, Madam Chair, we are absolutely trying to strike a balance here so that everything doesn't go to the people. And that necessarily creates the issue of where is the dividing line between things that go to the people and things that don't go to the people. And that, you know, they're going to be gray area cases. If we can, with words like nominal, help reduce the ambiguity in certain cases, let's do that. But let me just be really clear on the record. We're not trying to create an amendment to the legislature, amendment to the Constitution that sends every tax, fee, deduction, question to the people. We're trying to have some of the things go to the people, that is, a change in the nominal rate of tax or an increase, a new tax, but certain things do not go to the people. Fees, for instance, deductions. Implied changes to the rate of tax that don't change the nominal rate of tax.
Okay, thank you. I've just been reminded that Senator Reinbold is online. I don't know if she is unmuted, has been unmuted during this time, but Senator Reinbold, if you have any questions or comments along the way, please feel free to interject. Do you have anything you'd like to add to the conversation at this point?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am good. It's a very interesting conversation, and I really appreciate the discussion.
Thank you. Senator Michicki?
So what I'm on guard against is telling the people we're doing something that we're not really doing, and it reminds me a little bit of the current spending limit in the Constitution. And if you read back through those transcripts, and this is relevant to this discussion. If you read back through the transcripts, they wanted to put something that sounded like a spending limit, yet it was a big joke because they knew it actually had no effect on the spending. So if you're setting something up, anytime you allow a workaround, and you might be uncomfortable with this, but that's okay. That's the way that I kind of see it. I think it sets something up. If we're going to send this to the people to vote, they should actually truly understand, because there's not a tax on the corporate taxes, fuel taxes, fish taxes, alcohol taxes, cannabis taxes, oil taxes that you can't find a workaround if that's what you're going to do. So you can either send it to the people in a way that's kind of more pure, and you know how I feel about this kind of whole thing, or you can put words in that make it a lot more flexible, and that could bring some creativity out from the legislature. But I'm going to withdraw my objection, Madam Chair, on amendment number 3.
It's been a good discussion. Thank you. Are there any further objections to amendment number 3? Hearing none, amendment 3 has been adopted. And I will move the final amendment on SJR 4. I move amendment number 4.
I object for discussion.
Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Buddy Witt for the record. Amendment number 4 is page 2, line 19. After section 1, we put in C. So this has to do with enactment. It's just a carve out for specifically Article 9, section 1C for the amendment that we passed just 2 amendments ago. So that, except for that certain provision in amendment number 2, enactment would be as follows in that section.
Is there any question or discussion on amendment number 4? Hearing none, do you maintain your objection, Senator Michicki?
I do not. I remove my objection, Madam Chair.
Thank you for doing that. And hearing none, the amendment number 4 has been adopted. And with that, we are going to set SJR 4 aside and take up Senate Bill 33. And we have a new working document, and we'll take a second so we can kind of get ready for the next piece of legislation. All right, so we have a new working document for SB 33 to introduce, and Senator Keel has some amendments for this. So committee members received a copy of that document, in fact, and the explanation of changes yesterday from my office. So if Mr. Witt could come back up to the table, and then Senator Michicki, would you please make a motion to move the new working document?
Madam Chair, I move the CS for Senate Bill 33, work order number 31-GS1030/U be adopted as our working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. Mr. Witt, please take the committee through the summary of changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Buddy Witt, staff to Chair Hughes. The first change in the new working in the new draft, this would be version U, is in the title. We added a piece to the title relating to the duties of a prosecuting attorney, and we'll speak more to that later on in the bill. In section 1, two pieces of intent language were added to the bill. The first piece is located on page 1, starting on line 12. It goes through page 2, line 3. This adds intent language that the legislature it's the intent of the legislature that the court may consider self-improvement efforts of the defendant while in a pretrial status when imposing a sentence of imprisonment. And the second piece of intent language is on page 2, lines 4 through 7. This specific language was requested from the Department of Corrections, and this is the language they gave us back. But the legislature would like the Department of Corrections to develop a plan to track and measure the effectiveness of evidence-based programs offered to offenders and report its progress on the plan to both the House and Senate Judiciary Committees during the second regular session of the 31st Alaska State Legislature. The next change is in Section 7. This is on page 7, line 19. Section 7 is a very long section. It is and what Section 7 does is it repeals and reenacts AS 1230-011, released before trial. And this particular change happens, as I said, on page 7, line 19. And what this says basically is that the Department of Corrections shall detain a person until their test results indicates the person's breath and until someone is not intoxicated, legally intoxicated any longer. And this is in order to release someone on bail. Will not be released. It used to say may. This is simply changing to shall. So the Department of Corrections shall keep someone in detention until they are legally sober.
Mr. Witt, on page 7, line 19, where the may is changed to shall, it appears when it was drafted, you cannot tell that change was made because they, you know, usually how they bold, underline, and put in parentheses what's being taken out. That was not done.
Yes, so, and that's because this entire section, the entire AS 1230-011 is repealed and reenacted. So we repealed an entire section of law, and we're reenacting an entire section of law, which means nothing in this section. You're not going to see anything bolded or underlined or bracketed because we're putting in an entire new section.
Okay, that makes sense. I thought maybe when you were moving from one version to another version, it would show, but it does not. So I just want to point that out. Okay, and continue, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next change occurs in Section 9. That's found on page 8, lines 8 through 10. And in this section has to do with third-party custodianship. This change would make it a little bit more difficult for someone to be a third-party custodian if they were, in fact, a previous felon. This was spoken to, and this was a suggestion both from Senator Michicki and Senator Hughes. And I believe Senator Reinbold also spoke to this when the bill was initially introduced to the committee. So the proposed language in this section is now says that a person could not have been unconditionally discharged within the previous 5 years for a felony, and they cannot be have committed a crime under AS 1141, that is, crimes against a person, or similar crimes in this or another jurisdiction. And there was concern. The chair met with the Department of Corrections, the Department of Law, and with legislative legal. There was a concern that this would have make it very, very difficult for people to get a third-party custodian. The fallback on that is someone needed pretrial supervision, as we now have a pretrial services division that can offer that supervision as well. But we certainly, the chair certainly, and Senator Michicki certainly did not want a bad actor to be able to be in control of someone in pretrial.
And I'll just add to that explanation. The purpose isn't so it's more difficult for someone to be a custodian, third-party custodian. The purpose is so that the custodian is a better role model for the person as they're overseeing the offender. So that's the purpose. Can you explain the difference between before it was convicted and now unconditionally discharged, just how that works out? Because you could have someone who the previous language was had been convicted in the previous 3 years, so somebody could have been convicted and in jail for 2 years and 9 months and then be out, and they would be able to be a custodian. And now, explain the difference when you use the term unconditionally discharged.
Yes, ma'am. To the chair, unconditionally discharged, or as they use in the business off paper, means someone is completely off parole, off probation. They've completed all of their prescribed time for a sentence.
And the reason I gave the 2 year 9 months, because that person has only been outside of DOC custody for 3 months and has not proven him or herself on the street that they can stay within the law. What we've added here is the person has to have been able to stay within the law for a 5 year period. So that person therefore is would make a better role model as a custodian and more reliable probably too. Senator Michicki.
Well, I agree with you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the change, and I think it goes further than the role model. That's for the way you and I live our lives. We think that it should just be a better role model, but I'm intimately familiar with cases where they're actually reaching out to be a third-party custodian to use the person for much less honorable reasons than just someone to be a negative role model around. So I think this is a huge improvement. And if you looked at how the timing worked before, actually, if they were convicted in 3 years ago and they were just released, they would have been been eligible to be a third-party custodian. So this is a much better change. Still not a big fan of the third-party custodian program, but I hope that the courts will be strict in their usage only when the conditions are as good as possible.
Thank you for those comments. And part of what we're trying to do here is influence folks, I mean, throughout this whole Judiciary Committee process this year and I believe next year, is for the sake of public safety, is justice for victims, but also ensuring our offenders have every opportunity to turn their lives around and try to have the circumstances such that will be pointing them in that direction. So this change in the committee substitute fits in with that. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's a big change, and there are parts of it that I think make sense. I'm just sort of trying to wrap my brain around it. The example of someone who's was convicted 3 years ago and walks out the gate, it's almost certainly going to be a probationer. If not I suppose it could be a parolee, but if they straight timed it, they'd be a probationer. So they weren't eligible anyway, right under four of this subsection. So the shift from unconditional discharge to from conviction to unconditional discharge is potentially a significant shift in, well, is a significant shift in when the clock starts. Both changing when the clock starts and extending it from 3 to 5, do we have any sense of the scope of how many people does that take out of the potential population of third-party custodians?
We could bring the Department of Corrections up. Would you like to comment on that, Mr. Witt, or would you like the Department of Corrections to be your lifeline on that one?
The Department of Corrections will be the lifeline on it. I will say, though, Madam Chair, Senator Keel, through the chair, we can get an answer to your question, but I will say this for the chair: the number of people who would not be eligible to be third-party custodians was not a concern. It was making sure that the people who were third-party custodians were not the type of people that shouldn't be third-party custodians. But Department of Corrections can come up and answer that question, Madam Chair.
So, Jen or Kelly, would one of you, it sounds like you were happy with Mr. Witt's response, or would you like to come up?
For the record, this is Jen Winkleman, Director of Division of Probation and Parole for the Department of Corrections. And yeah, we were satisfied with Mr. Witt's response that it would be an unconditional discharge from probation after they were done.
No question.
Yes, Senator Michicki?
I may have a misunderstanding of how the prison system works, but is everyone that's released from prison on probation?
Through the chair, to Senator Michicki, no. It would depend on whether or not their judgment ordered it to probation, or if they had enough time that they were going to be released on mandatory parole.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator
Keel?
Just briefly, I think that the shift to unconditional discharge may actually make a fair amount of sense. It's the shift from, as we start that clock later, the shift from 3 years to 5 years, and then including all felonies, regardless of whether they're crimes against a person or not, is another really big move. And I guess I would just the reason this gives me concern is that we're not picking role models; we're picking people to do some supervision. I am worried that we really limit access to release for people who could be adequately supervised for lack of Boy Scouts. That's my concern.
All right. So the come on up, Mr. Witt, if you wish to. I would say that when I mentioned role model, maybe that wasn't the best way to say it. We're talking about people that have proven that they can be responsible and be outside of the constraints of any type of Department of Corrections oversight. They've proven themselves, and 5 years of being perhaps clean, sober, and living within the law is an important way to prove that you're ready to supervise someone. So, Mr. Witt, do you have anything else to add?
No, Madam Chair.
Any other question or comment?
I actually don't know how we I'm struggling with there being any problem with expecting a basic level of life management on the people that are going to be supervising people that are out on pretrial. So I don't have anything else. I appreciate the change, Madam Chair.
Right, Mr. Witt, did continue. We're at Section 10.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 10, the change in Section 10 actually, this is a new section that was added. This is on page 8, lines 21 through 26. And this amends AS 1255025, which some have referenced to be called, this is a piece of what was called the Truth in Sentencing Act. And what this says is that when imposing a sentence of imprisonment, the court will verbally describe on the record the sentence that is imposed as and verbally state the requirements of 1255025A3. And there's a subsection A and B to 1255025A3. I apologize. I didn't bring the description with me, and I was going to lay out what that specifically said. But to the best of my recollection, the court would have to say the sentence imposed, the minimum amount of time that one may serve based upon what is. Mandatory parole and other guidelines, the court would have to say that verbally on the record. And again, apologize. I'd like to read that statute.
And I actually have it here, so I can read it. It's from Section 1255025 Sentencing Procedures, and I'll pick up kind of the tail end. The court shall prepare as part of the record a sentencing report that includes the following, and it's got a couple items, but the ones we're focused on are 3A and B, A3, as mentioned in Section 10. So A3 is a clear statement of the terms of the sentence imposed. If a term of imprisonment is imposed, the state must include, it's going to include two things. A, the approximate minimum term the defendant is expected to serve before being released or placed on mandatory parole if the defendant is eligible for and does not forfeit good conduct deductions under AS 3320.010. And number two, if applicable, the approximate minimum term of imprisonment the defendant must serve before becoming eligible for release on discretionary parole. So basically, the court's already preparing this in a report, giving the sentence, and that includes the approximate minimum term if mandatory parole applies, the approximate minimum term if discretionary parole it applies. And I will say in that statute too, these are approximate, and these reports are at this point I have a copy of what the report looks like. They're furnished in writing to the Department of Law, the defendant, the Department of Corrections, and the State Board of Parole if they're going to be eligible for parole, and if in certain cases to the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. There's also part of the statute that the word approximate minimum terms are for information purposes only. The approximate minimum terms are not part of the sentence imposed and do not form a basis for review or appeal of the sentence imposed or provide a defendant with a right to any specific term of imprisonment or supervised release on mandatory parole. So an oral report, it's if because it's approximate and the judge would use the word may, it won't be something that we could turn around and have a case and be back in court about. So I just want to make that clear. I also want to state, while we're on this, that Nancy Mead provided a copy for us of what one of these forms looks like that the defendant is given. And in that form, Part A is incarceration, and it lists boxes where you put in the period of time, the suspended time, and then the total unsuspended term, and then there's a checkbox related to discretionary parole. So I wanted to point out at least this particular form is not meeting the current statute exactly because it only reports the discretionary parole, does not report the mandatory parole. So the court system might want to update that. I just want to get that on the record. And this is then provided to the Department of Law. The Department of Law is in touch with the victims, and so then can communicate that. One of the things that we've noticed, or I've noticed, and we probably all have noticed, is that sometimes the people, victims, as well as the public at large, can be outraged when they realize how soon someone is getting out. And part of it is, I believe, is a lack of educating people how it works. So somebody might be sentenced to 20 years, 5 years is suspended, so that takes it down to 15. But then they are eligible for mandatory parole, which takes it down to 10. And then if they're good and they get discretionary parole, it's down to 5. So here they are sentenced to 20 years, and they're only serving 5. And sometimes victims are taken aback by that. So we think it's important that it's communicated orally and according to the statute. And we also think that the report needs to be corrected as well, so that the mandatory piece is in there. So all that information then is available to the victim and to the public. And we also know sometimes in high-profile cases, the media is in the courtroom and reporters are listening. And we believe that if the judge states it orally, it would be something that would get out more correctly to the people. So that is the purpose of this, improving the truth in sentencing statute. So I just thought I'd clarify that. Is there any question about that? Senator Keel?
Madam Chair, a question maybe for the court system. I just don't sort of have a clear sense of how it works. These forms are filled out after the sentence is handed down and sent on. What is it? I guess I have this image in my head that may very well be wrong. I could use correction of a judge listening to all the parties at the sentencing hearing, considering all the factors and deciding on a sentence. Does that give a judge enough time to do the math here? I mean, I wouldn't do Ms. Winkleman's time accounting work for all the tea in China.
Well, I did want to point out, that's why I read the part that said that it doesn't hold. This is for informational purposes. Mm-hmm. And it cannot be used, and the judge uses the word may, it's approximate. And it's pretty clear cut. Talking to Nancy Mead, it can be complicated for certain things, but they'll just have to make the point to maybe have a cheat sheet for some of that complicated stuff and make it clear that it's may. But the law already covers it, so it can't be used. However, it's reported in a way that will bog down our courts, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. I guess that's the point of my question. Is I don't want to have a situation where a judge has a vague sense in mind and comes to the sentencing hearing, hears the victim impact statement, and says, no, my sense was wrong, and then looks at the math and goes, maybe I'll go with the original. I just don't know how that.
And I will say, when I read 1255.025 for the first time, I thought, and I did not research this, but my guess is the intent of the legislature was actually so people had the information of, yes, someone is sentenced to 20 years, but that could be 10 or 5 actually behind bars. And I think that is information that's important to the victim to know, and it's important for the public to know. So is there any further discussion on that before we move on? Because I think we have one more summary of change, Mr. Witt?
We have one more section to go over, yes, ma'am.
Okay, if you want to finish that one up.
The final change happens in section 15. This is on page 10, and this would be lines 1 through 4. And this relates back to a previous section, and as it relates to the notification of when an offender is discharged from a treatment program for noncompliance while in pretrial. And again, this was from a number of members of the committee, I believe Senator Michicki and Senator the Chair Hughes specifically brought up that the victim needed to be, and Senator Reinbold brought up that the victim needed to be contacted and notified if an offender was discharged from a treatment program for noncompliance. Specifically, and this relates to language and other pieces of legislation that have come before this committee, this relates specifically to crimes involving domestic violence and sex crimes. There is one fix that will be coming in an amendment. I know this is news to the chair. There will be one fix as is right now. It does not specify pretrial, so we will have clarification language that this is for an offender in a pretrial status. As it applies now, it could be for anyone at any point in probation, parole, pretrial.
Okay, Senator Reinbold, do you have any thing you'd like to bring to the committee's attention or question?
Well, thank you, Chair Hughes. I really appreciate it. I think this is an excellent idea. I really appreciate you coming and making a meeting and discussing it with me, because I think it's an excellent idea, and I absolutely support this amendment.
Thank you.
And that concludes the explanation of changes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. And I will remove my objection at this point, and hearing no further objections, the CS is adopted. Senator Keel has some amendments today. So, Senator Keel.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the first one I actually want to offer as a conceptual amendment, because as I was getting ready, I realized that it didn't do what it needs to do to be functional. So if I may offer Amendment 1 is a conceptual amendment.
Is it a conceptual amendment to Amendment Number 1?
Yes.
Yes, please.
So you should move your amendment first.
Thank you. Move your amendment, please. Move Amendment 1.
Object.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. I have a conceptual amendment to Amendment 1, and that is, it's probably best described on page 2 of the bill, which is where the first change would take place. This simply restores a 24-hour deadline for a person who's been arrested to be taken in front of a judge or a magistrate. But what I neglected to do, so conceptual amendment one to amendment one, would put back the words on page 2, line 10, absent compelling circumstances, which the underlying bill deletes, which would restate those, put them back in the law. And then at line 16, 17, 18, also put back the sentence, the hearing before the judge or magistrate may not take place more than 48 hours after arrest. So, and I need the conceptual amendment, otherwise it's more restrictive than the old law and would be bad policy. So,
I object.
To the conceptual?
Yeah.
Would you like to speak to that, Senator Michicki?
Yeah, I mean, because we already have extenuating circumstances on the 48 and the 24, so it's unnecessary, and it seems to make the amendment better, but I don't support the conceptual amendment to Amendment 1.
Madam Chair,
Senator Keel?
I'd just point out that the compelling circumstances here and go away in the underlying bill. So they'd need to be reinstated to have the 24 hours be workable. The 48 hours in the underlying bill, it's a pretty hard cap.
Senator Michicki?
I'm sure the Department of Law made it perfectly clear that all they have to do is notify the court when they're going to go over the 24-hour today, which they expected happen. Doesn't happen all that often. They try to get them before a judge at 24 hours. Sometimes it's not possible. They would have the same ability to do so at 48 hours, but would be needed much less often because it gives adequate time for other things to occur that may be being rushed today.
And my understanding, too, is that 95% of the cases now are heard within 24 hours, and I'm going back to the underlying amendment, but that the 48 hours, when we're talking about recruitment and retention and treating people that are working, having to go in on weekends, on Saturdays, on holidays, that 48 hour for that small 5% would be very helpful. So, Senator Keel, you have a conceptual amendment on the table, and I'm also going to oppose it. So at this point, do you want to move forward with your the amendment number one?
Madam Chair, the conceptual amendment's necessary to even have a serious discussion of Amendment 1. So if there's not the interest in making it functional for debate, then I'll withdraw.
Okay, Amendment number 1 is withdrawn. Senator Keel, Amendment number 2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment 2.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
That one's U.2. Is that, do I have the right one there? I have these electronically, so they're not. Yes. Okay, let me just get to the right point in the bill, page 3. Madam Chair, this amendment deals with the opportunity to request a judicial review of the conditions of release when someone is unable to meet the conditions of their release. The Department of Law talked about the clear and convincing standard being something they found challenging. Amendment number 2 is offered to replace the clear and convincing standard rather than deleting it entirely with a preponderance of the evidence standard so that the legislature continues to provide some guidance to the court as to what we're looking at, the least restrictive conditions that reasonably ensure the appearance of the person in court and the safety of the victim, the safety of other persons in the community. But by leaving a standard in place, we frankly open up the opportunity for the prosecution to make the case, but we nevertheless leave some guidance to the court in the statutes. And so we, I think, effectively handle the public safety concern. We restore some of that discretion that the Department of Law was looking for without sort of saying, in essence, whatever goes.
If the Department of Law, Ms. Schroeder, if you'd like to come up and speak to this amendment. And also, I see Mr. Skidmore is online. Mr. Skidmore, would you like to speak to this proposed amendment, please?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. This is Tom Skidmore. I'm the director of the Department of Law. And the question posed to me is the Department of Law's position on Amendment Number 2. The department, while I appreciate what Senator Keel has attempted to do with changing the preponderance standard, changing the burden of proof from clear and convincing to preponderance, the problem that this amendment still poses is that it says when the court sets bail and initially sets all the conditions that it deems to be appropriate, that the judicial officer shall revise the conditions unless they find by preponderance of the evidence that it can't reasonably do these other things. But they've already made that determination previously. So what this doesn't do is it doesn't require the notion that there be something new in circumstances or facts that should cause a judge to have to revisit the concept of where bail is set. In other words, setting the standard at preponderance is correct, but requiring the judge to do this all over again makes the law more murky and difficult and suggests that judges should be taking additional steps to ensure that someone gets released, essentially asking them to second guess their initial determination. And that's not necessary. That's actually, I would argue, inappropriate. When the judge makes the initial determination, that's the appropriate determination. And if there is new information that comes to light, that's when there should be a subsequent bail hearing. Absent that, there is no reason to go back and revisit that decision, which has already been made with all of the factors appropriately considered.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Are there other comments or questions regarding Amendment Number 2? Senator Keel?
Well, Madam Chair, just to note that the underlying bill doesn't take away the ability to ask for to have the conditions reviewed. It's in there still. So that opportunity to second guess second guessing isn't the point, to reconsider is what's at issue here, or rather remains in the underlying bill. What Amendment 2 would do is this is one of these things that's going to apply in threshold cases, Madam Chair. When a judge has looked at a case and a defendant and said, this is a person that we don't want on the street, you know, there's going to be a pretty clear, easy finding, right, by a preponderance of the evidence that victims aren't going to be safe, other people aren't going to be safe. In those threshold cases where a judge has set a series of conditions, they reasonably think the person can probably meet them, and for any number of reasons, 48 hours later, that person isn't able to meet them, they can go back in and ask to have another look. And this simply, you know, what Amendment 2 leaves in place is a sense that, yeah, if as long as people are safe, as long as the person's going to show up again for their court date, Your Honor, please, you should take another look.
Mr. Skidmore, would you like to respond to that, please?
Madam Chair, when I look at the amendment, while I again agree with Senator Keel that a person is entitled to come back and have a bail hearing, the language that the judicial officer shall revise conditions is what creates that confusion. I understand there's an unless later on, but what I'm indicating is that it's requiring the judicial officer to change things and make a finding all over again. I guess another way of saying is because it's superfluous language, it's language that's not needed, it tends to create confusion to the standard that already exists. I'm not disagreeing with Senator Keel that a person has a right to another bail hearing after 48 hours. I agree with that. I agree that it should be a preponderance of the evidence. What I don't agree with is the language that says the judicial officer shall revise conditions unless. That standard's already set forth in sort of a different manner, and what this does is it tries to shift the presumption. It shifts a presumption from has there been new information that should change the court's opinion, and instead says the fact that the person hasn't been released means that the court should release them. That's not the appropriate standard. The appropriate standard is you can have another hearing, there's new information, will consider that new information, but it doesn't mean that I shall release you. I start with the presumption that we had a bail hearing, I've set bail, and that what I set it at, I being the judge, did that appropriately. This is saying you have to start with the opposite presumption that you shall release them, even though you've already determined that there were appropriate conditions.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. I'm going to maintain my objection. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
Senator Keel?
Yes.
Senator Reinbold? Senator Schauer? Senator Michicki?
No.
Chair Hughes?
No.
Madam Chair, I can't hear the Secretary.
I'm sorry, Senator Reinbold, we're... I know you'd like to vote on this, but you're not able to vote over the phone, unfortunately.
I thought I was allowed to vote on amendments, but I'm not allowed to vote bills off committee. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take an at ease. We're back on record, and you are correct. I am sorry about that, Senator Reinbold. So the secretary, let's void the roll, and if you would please, Madam Secretary, call the roll again.
There's no microphone for the secretary.
Shelley, I can't hear her. I'm sorry. I'm a no vote.
Okay. We've got you on record. Thank you. Continue, Madam Secretary.
Senator Schauer? Senator Muchiki?
No.
Senator Keel?
Yes.
Chair Hughes?
No.
One yay, three nays.
So on a vote of one yay and three nays, the amendment fails. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment 3, which is /U.3.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This goes we're on page 3, lines 24, 25. This amendment goes to the question of reviewing conditions of release based on a person's inability to post the required bail. And so this puts back the notion that new information does include the person's inability to pay, inability to post the required bail. But it adds a requirement there that it only includes a person's inability to post the required bail if the person can show that the person made a good faith effort to post the required bail. So in the original introduction of the bill, we heard the notion that folks can come back in and sort of clog up the system. This would, again, be one of these amendments that really only applies in the threshold case. When a judge says, this is a dangerous person, $1 million cash only bond, I mean, the judge isn't going to change that decision. They're clearly making a decision based on a massive risk. When a person has made a good faith effort to post the required bail and was not able to, this gives them one shot, and that's the second part of the amendment, which you'll see at page 3, lines 30 through 31. A person may receive only one bail review hearing solely for an ability to pay. So a judge set a money bail that a person thought they could make. They called their spouse. They called their brother and said, you know, sell my everything, whatever it is, and just was not able to put together that cash bond. This gives that person one opportunity, having made a real effort, to go back to the judge and say, you know, here is everything I was able to get together in addition to meeting all the other requirements. You get one shot at that to make a case to the judge, who's not required, I don't believe, in that situation, to amend the bail. This simply restores that one shot.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Mr. Skidmore, we're coming up on the clock here, so briefly you could respond to this amendment, and then we're going to move right into voting on it. Mr. Skidmore?
Good afternoon. For the record, this is John Skidmore. I appreciate Senator Keel's attempts to limit the application of this, but my response would still be that on page 6 of the CS, there are 4 factors that require a judge to consider a person's ability to pay when bail is initially set. And once that determination is made, the bail is set, taking that into consideration as well as the other factors about the crime and the person's history. And so the fact that they cannot then come up with all of the money should not be changing the initial determination of what assets did they have available, what was their employment history, how long have they been in their residence, and their family ties to the community. So this is not an amendment that the Department of Law would be supporting.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Madam Secretary, would you please call the roll? And Senator Reinbold, you will be – can you just tell us what your vote is on the amendment?
Senator
Senator Reinbold, we're going to call the roll, and then I will call on you last for amendment number 3. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
No.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Reinbold.
Senator Reinbold.
No.
Chair Hughes.
No.
1 yay, 3 nays.
So in a vote of 1 yay and 3 nays, the amendment has failed. Senator Keel, amendment number 4.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment 4, which is /U.4.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amendment 4 is designed to restore the pretrial risk assessment as an optional tool. We have heard in testimony, I can't remember if it was on this bill or another bill, from the Judicial Council about the usefulness of the pretrial assessment tool in reducing some of the concerning differentials in our justice system. And we have seen in other legislative committees, which I'm sure all of you are following as I have, that some of the initial results of the pretrial risk assessment tool are promising. And so it seems a shame to take that useful tool out of the toolbox. I am aware that there are some perceived deficits with the pretrial risk assessment tool. And so by making this an optional factor that a judge can consider, it puts that tool in front of them to use one objective measure among the many other measures that they have available in the statute in determining whether to release someone or, if not to release someone on recognizance, what conditions to set. That one objective measure of risk, along with the others that we have seen in the statute, is a valuable thing. So, and that's why I recommend vote on Amendment 4.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Mr. Skidmore, would you like to speak on Amendment number 4?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is John Skidmore for the record. I would like to applaud Senator Keel for this particular amendment. It's very intriguing, unfortunately, and it's an amendment that the administration received just earlier today, and we have not had a chance to fully digest whether we think that this would be something that would work or not. And so at this time, we're not going to take any position on the amendment. It's an idea that, like I said, we're interested in considering, but we just haven't been able to finish that consideration at this time, so I'm not prepared to take a position at this moment.
Senator Maticki?
Madam Chair, I'm prepared to take a position, as you can probably imagine. I don't know where the promising assumptions come from, because all I'm seeing is irresponsible releases in many different communities around the state of people that continue to reoffend. I do not support the pretrial risk assessment. I do not support the criteria of the assessment being outside of the realm of the legislature. And I believe that when it was created, it was using the wrong criteria and was extremely generous in its release factors. So I don't support the pretrial risk assessment at all. Therefore, I will not be supporting this amendment.
And thank you for that. I won't be supporting either. Senator Keel, I appreciate your comments, and I think that it also would trigger fiscal note. We're looking at a sizable expense with the revision of the criminal statutes as is. But I know one of the requirements is that there be constant updating of this, and this is there's a cost factor to that. And also, people are ending up on the street, and my understanding is pretty hard for anybody to get anything but low risk, and that's a problem. I don't think it's been working, and so I'll be opposing it. Senator Reinbold, did you have any comments on this amendment number 4?
I have to leave very shortly.
Madam Chair, I absolutely support your comments as well as Senator McChickie's. I'm thankful that Senator Keel is so engaged, but I will be a no vote.
All right. I'm going to maintain my objection. And because Senator Reinbold is on the phone and the secretary does not have a microphone, I'm going to ask Mr. Witt if he would please call the roll.
Senator Schauer. Senator Machicki.
No.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Reinbold.
No.
Chair Hughes.
No.
One yay, three nays.
So on a vote of one yay and three nays, the amendment has failed. Amendment number five, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm conscious of the time. I move amendment five, which is U.5.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This goes to page 9, line 30. So this is the limit on a court granting sentence, or granting credit, excuse me, against a sentence of imprisonment for inpatient treatment. There are inpatient treatment programs that exceed 180 days. And so this would set that cap at 360 days so that we don't have a disincentive to completing treatment programs where they are necessary.
Thank you, Senator Keel. And I'll speak to this one because we did some research. The maximum treatment program that we found was 180 days. Most of them are less than that, so I will not be supporting this amendment. And with that, Mr. Witt, would you please call the roll?
Senator Schauer. Senator Machicki.
No.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Reinbold.
No.
Chair Hughes.
No.
One yay, three nays.
So on a vote of one yay and three nays, the amendment has failed. Amendment number six, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment six, which is U.6.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This one has a little tweak to the title. We actually have discussed this previously. This is the portion of the bill that makes a court rule change. I'll be overly simplistic, that lets your lawyer consent to a delay for you or even potentially over your objection. I just have a philosophical objection to that. I think if you want to screw up your case by running a trial, even if your lawyer says he needs a delay, it's on you, and it shouldn't be your lawyer's call.
Senator Machicki, would you like to speak to that?
Well, I think Mr. Skidmore would be the best person for this. I know I don't support it, but he will be able to point us to the sections of the bill that and why the change is important.
Mr. Skidmore, amendment number six, if you please speak to it.
Madam Chair, the amendment here is doing essentially what Senator Keel indicates, is that he wants a defendant to have control over whether a case can be continued or not. And the reason that this was proposed to be changed so that the attorney really can speak to it without having to have their client weigh in on it is that this involves a tactical decision in the case. And though I appreciate Senator Keel's philosophical opposition, that philosophical opposition doesn't take into consideration the additional downstream consequences in the legal system and all of the additional work that's associated with giving that additional ability to a defendant. There is substantial more work that that creates when we say we want to do this just because it makes us feel better or philosophically we like the way that sounds better. The amendment proposed here, I encourage the committee not to support the change that is in the bill is to make our judicial system, our criminal justice system, more efficient, and that's ultimately the reason it was proposed.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Mr. Witt, would you please call the roll?
Senator Schauer. Senator Machicki.
No.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Reinbold.
No.
Chair Hughes.
No.
One yay, three nays.
So on a vote of one yay and three nays, the amendment number six has failed. And that was our final amendment. Thank you, Mr. Keel, for bringing those forward. So because one of the rules is we have to have a majority of our committee, not of those that are present, in order to move a bill out, we are also going to set this bill aside. Are there any comments from committee members before we adjourn? Seeing none, let the record reflect that the time that we are adjourning is 3:20.